Muy bien. Bueno, voy a comenzar con la presentación. No sé si hacerla en español o en inglés. Quizá la hago en español y en algún momento puedo traducir alguna cosa. Bueno, tenemos con nosotros un paper que a mí me ha parecido maravilloso. Luego comentaré algo sobre el mismo, haré alguna pregunta. El profesor Adam Sutcliffe es profesor de Historia Europea en el King's College de la Universidad de Londres. Por lo que he visto en su página web dentro del colegio, estudió en la Universidad de Cambridge, ¿no? Y luego hizo su tesis doctoral en el University College de Londres, del que también estamos hablando ahora, fundado por Jeremy Bentham, donde se conserva su momia y en algunos momentos se puede visitar, aunque también se puede visitar el pub Bentham, que está justamente enfrente.
Sin la cabeza.
Sin la cabeza. Efectivamente.
La cabeza es
el
Lo
robaron. Bueno, el profesor Alan es especialista en la historia del papel del judaísmo, me ha parecido entender un poco, en la cultura europea, las relaciones entre judaísmo, pensadores judíos y no judíos en el pensamiento moderno. Tiene una obra que a mí me impresionó muchísimo, publicada en la Universidad de Cambridge, Cambridge University Press, sobre judaísmo e ilustración. Tiene una historia de la cultura judía desde Al-Ándalus hasta el momento un poco del pensamiento ilustrado, el Sahaja. Y tiene algo que lo he descubierto esta misma tarde y me he prometido leerlo directamente, un libro sobre historia, memoria y vida pública, History, Memory and Public Life, the Past and the Present, sobre el papel de la memoria histórica en países que tienen una relación, diríamos que conflictiva, con su pasado. Sudáfrica, Irlanda del Norte, Australia, y yo pensaba, y seguramente España, y además en los últimos días especialmente interesante. Ha trabajado muchísimo sobre Spinoza y el judaísmo. También ha publicado artículos sobre Mendelssohn, y yo creo que esos son dos temas que se mezclan muy bien en su paper. En condiciones normales nuestro funcionamiento es tener un comentarista, pero esta mañana hemos descubierto que, nos ha comunicado que está enfermo. The person who was going to comment your paper, he was taken ill, so in this situation, yo creo que vamos a comenzar directamente con las preguntas, algún comentario que va a hacer María José, que yo le agradezco muchísimo. Yo también puedo hacer algún comentario, podemos, digamos, lanzarnos a preguntar, o yo no sé si prefieres un poco, a lo mejor, resumir tu propio paper, como en algunas ideas fundamentales del mismo en las que a lo mejor te gustaría centrarte.
Sí. Primero yo, primero
as you like it.
El autor primero.
I thought that perhaps it would be better if you.
Okay, sure. Yes, happy to do so. Thank you very much, Gerardo, for your very lovely introduction to me. I'm sorry I won't speak in Spanish, because some of you have heard already my spoken Spanish is terrible. But I lived in Italy for 2 years and I learned very good French at school, so I can understand pretty much everything in Spanish, but when I try to speak, it comes out as mostly as Italian.
I think everybody here understands your English anyway.
Okay, and the English will be fine for everybody. Good, okay. Thank you. So, I'd like to explain really what this paper comes from, because it's actually an extract from a book manuscript that, in fact, is already in press. I'm interested in audio criticisms, but sadly, except in the proof stage, it would be too late for me really to correct the mistakes before publication. It's taken from a book that will come out from Princeton University Press next spring called What Are Jews For? Does that make sense to everybody? What are Jews for? Question mark. History, peoplehood, and purpose is the subtitle. I had an argument with the press, Princeton University Press. At first, they didn't want me to use that title because they were worried that it might sound to some people as a bit anti-Semitic, that I could be arguing that Jews are useless, they have no purpose at all in the world.
Better off without them.
But I persuaded them that the provocation of the question mark and of the title was important to my project and to the argument of the project, which is that it's about the idea of Jews having a world historical purpose, which has its foundations in it has some foundations in Jewish thought itself, the Jews' own traditions from the Talmudic period of how they understand themselves as fitting into the destiny of the entire world. It's also very important in Christian thought, the idea that Jews are the are God's chosen people. They are punished for having rejected Jesus Christ, but their special status in God's eyes still remains. And at the end of time, they will convert to Christianity, and in some way, that reunification of Jews with Christianity and with God will usher in the Messianic era. So that's the Christian underlay of this idea, which has Jewish medieval forms as well. But my project tracks the idea of Jews and their world historical purpose from 1600 to the present. So I discuss the medieval period as a background, but this is really about early modern and modern history, and about the way in which this idea of Jews having a world historical purpose has taken on successive layers of signification over the last four centuries. A bit like a palimpsest?
Yes.
A manuscript where you can... new layers above, but you can see the past layers below. So nothing is erased. Underlay of earlier forms are still visible, but subsequent significances. And in the 19th and 20th century, their predominantly secular conceptions of Jewish purpose get superimposed on these earlier meanings. So, the subtitle of the book, What Are Jews For?, is History, Peoplehood, and Purpose. History, because it is a history. I trace four centuries of time. But it's also about peoplehood. Does everybody understand?
Yeah.
Peoplehood. Yeah? Yeah. Please stop me if anyone needs to translate people. So, the Jews are the are emblematic of peoplehood in the Western tradition. A people apart, a people with a strong identity of themselves as separate from others. But other peoples, French, German, Spanish, English, in thinking about what their place in the world is and what their purpose is in the world as a particular people, have looked at the Jewish case as a fundamental reference point for the very idea that a people, with their difference and particularity, have a purpose, not simply in the self-interested pursuit of what is best for them, triumphing over others, but as something that contributes to the greater whole of human history. And that, I think, is a very important idea for all national collectives and their sense of purpose, and indeed groups that aren't national at all, religious groups, identity groups of all forms. So the book then, at one level, is a history of the idea of Jewish world historical purpose, but it has a philosophical aspect as well, in that I think this history is a gateway for understanding how we think about peoplehood and purpose in general today. And I think understanding the place of Jewish themes in Western thought in this way, which is really the central interest that runs through much of my work, we can move beyond some very tired paradigms on this subject, which have been dominated by a discussion of anti-Semitism or perhaps philo-Semitism, its opposite, hostility to Jews, love of the Jews, and the placing of various pronouncements on Jews on some sort of a spectrum of hostility to idealism. I think there are many problems with that paradigm. I avoid both those terms, anti-Semitic, philo-Semitic, or any judgmental terms really altogether in this project. I think it's much more fruitful to think about this special meaning as a people who is destined at the end of time in some way no longer to be a people, but to lead the world into a universal state of harmony. That is the central idea that frames Western thought about Jews. And it can take many different forms and can have very many different attitudes and emotions associated with it. And that's what I try to offer in the book. So after an introduction that discusses the medieval period, my first main chapter is on the 17th century, which I call Jews and political purpose. The 17th century I see as really the era of political theology. Some parts of that chapter are in this paper. It's when nation states, particularly in Northern Europe, really try to superimpose their significance onto the Jewish biblical model as their role as sort of Protestant chosen people in the world. Although, writing this in my Protestant homeland, I didn't think enough, really. I think about Catholicism. I just come today from the Escorial and was reflecting on the statues of David and Solomon in front of the Basilica and others, and Solomon and David being as the models for Philip II in his wisdom as the great king of the Counter-Reformation. So I think connections could be made, I'm sure, to Spain and the Habsburgs that I didn't make in this. An important theme in 17th century thought, certainly in the Protestant world, and a lot of my focus is on England for that period, is millenarianism or messianism, the idea that the messianic age is possibly very close. And there are also waves of messianism in the Jewish world as well, the Shabbatai Tzvi phenomenon. Shabbatai Tzvi declared himself the Jewish Messiah in Smyrna, Izmir, contemporary Turkey, in the 1660s, and won a big following among the Jewish world before, a few years later, converting to Islam, the duress from the Sultan of Turkey. In the chapter, the politics chapter, I place Shabbatai Tzvi alongside Spinoza and suggest that both of them are actually Jewish messianic figures. I mean, that's unusual there. It's unusual to place the two together, because Shabbatai Tzvi is seen as often a religious fanatic. Spinoza, particularly by philosophers, is thought of as a secular, rational person, distancing himself utterly from religion. But there are hints of messianism, as I discuss in the paper, in his work. And in the late 17th and into the 18th century, he becomes a sort of messiah of the Enlightenment, Jesus Christ of the Enlightenment, almost, celebrated by figures such as Lessing, who the German dramatist Gottfried Lessing, who's an important figure in my next chapter, the 18th century, which I call Jews of philosophical purpose. Lessing idealizes Spinoza very much and conflates his idealization of Spinoza with his idealization of his own friend, Moses Mendelssohn, the Jewish philosopher in 18th century Berlin, and really the first Jewish intellectual to have an impact in the public sphere of Enlightenment thought in 18th century Germany. So in this paper, I've pasted together, in a way, in some places slightly awkwardly, so I apologize for some continuity errors where I refer back to things in the paper that actually are not in the edited version that I've given you here. I've linked together the section on Spinoza in the 17th century chapter and the section on Lessing and Mendelssohn in the 18th century chapter to show how in the 18th century Mendelssohn and Spinoza have quite a lot in common, and Mendelssohn and also Lessing form a part of how in the 18th century Jews take on a philosophical purpose, sometimes as the binary opposite of Enlightenment rationalism. And I think this is how Pierre Bayle considers the Jews, essentially. But for someone like Lessing, who looks forward to a sort of messianic transformation into a new era of rational understanding, transcending the dogmas of conventional Christianity, an idealized vision of Jewish transformation is very important to him. And that's why, one of the reasons why Mendelssohn and Spinoza are so fascinating and important for him. And so there's a messianic strain there as well. Briefly to summarize the rest of the project, and then I think I should probably stop. My next chapter focuses on the 19th century, in which I call Jews and Social Purpose. For the 17th and the 18th century, Jews are imagined as the people who will usher a future universal world into being at some point in the future. But after the French Revolution, with important transformations also for the status of Jews in much of the West, at varying paces through Jewish emancipation, the inclusion of Jews into the political life of the countries of Western Europe. With that shift, there's a sense that this new future is already emerging. That future in the 19th century is now. So the question in terms of Jewish purpose is how Jews play a role in the present, in the 19th century present, in pushing forward the universalization of the post-Enlightenment world. And there are two key domains that I look at. One is the idea of the Jew as teacher, which is already present in Mendelssohn. I quote him in his writing saying that Jews will be teachers of pure ideas of spirituality to everybody else. That idea is very, very important in writings by various Jews and non-Jews in the 19th century. Another important area is the economic idea that Jews have a special relationship with capitalism, and in the development of capitalism, they are in some ways transforming the world into its destined modern state. And there are those who see that as a very good thing. There are those who see that as a bad thing. I mean, Karl Marx is an important and complex figure in that area. I then have two chapters covering the long 20th century. One focuses on nationalism, Jews and national purpose, because Zionism was seen by many Jewish Zionists as a project not just, or maybe even not primarily, for Jews, but a project that would be for the betterment of the world as a whole. This is very present in early Zionist thinkers in the 19th century. A phrase from the prophet Isaiah that David Ben-Gurion was very fond of using was to describe Israel as a light unto the nations. So that idea, I think, is very much emblematic of the purpose that Jewish nationalism has borne from the 19th century through the 20th and into the present in some ways. And my final chapter is moves away from the nationalism and covers the long 20th century through the lens of the question of normalization in modern culture. I call it normalization. I call the chapter Normalization and Its Discontents, using Freud and his text, Civilization and Its Discontents, as my starting point. Because in many different ways, Jewish thinkers in the long 20th century, Freud is just one important example, have to some degree attempted to normalize the place of Jews in the world. To say Jews are just like everybody else, and that arrival at a state of normality is the arrival to this common, shared, universal future in which divisions between peoples are overcome. Psychoanalysis is such an ideology, but ironically, psychoanalysis, because it was predominantly Jewish and its practitioners, certainly in the era of Freud, but also because if you look at Freud's writings, such as Moses and Monotheism, his late writings, really dealing with the question of Jewish, the place of Jews in history, the idea that Jews have a particularity that is unextinguishable, a special purity of abstraction. That's really how Freud saw it. The particularity keeps on returning, even within attempts to erase it. And I try to trace right up to the present very, very complicated confusions and arguments about this question of Jewish normalcy versus Jewish specialness, which I think continues to be very important in the muddle that people get into in discussions of Jewish matters, most controversially today in relation to anti-Semitism and Palestine-Israel conflict, removing those things in the present. So the question of the possibility or not and the meaning of overcoming normalization is an important theme in the book. And just to trace that back to Spinoza and Mendelssohn, and I'll stop, that same tussle is present in both Spinoza and Mendelssohn. Spinoza is also trying, I think, in my reading of the Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, to normalize the place of Jews in history, to say that the Jewish Bible, Christian Old Testament, it's just a record of one strange old tribe wandering around deserts several thousand years ago, with an overly vivid account of their past exploits, because they were rather primitive at that time and therefore needed this very colourful account of their history. But a sense of Jewish specialness nonetheless creeps back into his work, for example in his comments about circumcision and the possible return of a Jewish polity, that I quote from his text. So he's sort of trying to escape Jewish difference, but not entirely. And Mendelssohn really attempts the same thing in Jerusalem, his defense of Judaism in the language of the Enlightenment that he writes in the 1780s. He's trying to really give an account of Judaism that's palatable to his friends in the general German Enlightenment. But he also says, as I just mentioned, that the Jews have a particularly lofty notion of the divine because they avoid visual symbols, anything that could possibly slide towards idolatry. So there remains for Mendelssohn, despite himself, I would say, a sense of Jewish specialness and of mission to the rest of the world around the diffusion of that, the spreading of that specialness, even as at the same time, at the surface, he's attempting to present Jews as the same, Judaism as the same as Enlightenment philosophy. So these two figures then, I hope the connections between them are suggestive and interesting within this paper. I've tried to present that in the wider framework of the book as a whole, which you'll have to wait 6 months to see all of those angles embellished. I'll stop there because I've said a lot. I'm interested in more responses and thoughts.
A mí me han dicho, if you don't understand, I can
translate.
I apologize for my presentation because just a few points.
He's speaking French because he speaks perfect French.
Yes. So. Oh, you speak and say that. If you speak in Spanish, I'll be fine.
Bueno,
I will just. Fenomenal.
A mí me han dicho, me ha llamado María Luisa a las 2 de la tarde, bueno, estaba preparando la comida, y me ha dicho que el que tenía que comentar este paper, pues no podía venir porque está enfermo. Así que, bueno, pues he tenido un par de horas para inventarme algunos puntos y decir algunas cosas. Entonces, voy a centrarme en Spinoza. Hay algunas cosas, a mí me ha gustado mucho your paper, y lo único que quería hacer es añadir algunos puntos y muy centrados en Spinoza. ¿De acuerdo? Entonces, en primer lugar, bueno, además tengo que traducir porque lo he hecho en inglés. Claro, y ahora lo tengo que traducir lo que tengo aquí. Bueno,
there's no problem with that.
No, pero yo creo que tal vez sea mejor. La primera cosa, el primer punto es la The Jewish Social Framework, el contexto social judío en relación con Spinoza. La comunidad judía, ¿cómo era la comunidad judía? A mí me parece que es muy importante, bueno, en todos los autores es muy importante su biografía, y en este caso, muchísimo más tal vez, o más. Si Spinoza es un autor cuya defensa de la libertad es manifiesta, creo que su biografía explica muy bien por qué su interés, como un disidente que fue, explica esa defensa de la libertad que está presente en toda su obra, ¿no? Entonces, lo primero es el contexto judío. La comunidad judía de Ámsterdam en la época de Spinoza, nos situamos Spinoza en 1632-1677. La comunidad judía era una comunidad tolerada, únicamente tolerada por las autoridades holandesas. Esto significa que, no recuerdo exactamente cuándo los judíos empiezan a tener derechos políticos en Holanda, pero creo que Spinoza ya tenía derechos políticos. Creo que sí. Es en torno a 1630. En torno a 1630. Pero hasta esos momentos los judíos no tenían derechos políticos, aun habiendo nacido en Holanda. No eran ciudadanos. Entonces es una comunidad tolerada en el sentido en que puede tener sus sinagogas, es decir, practicar su religión. Es una especie como de gueto, en realidad. Y puede tener sus colegios donde se enseña la Torah. Pero esa tolerancia es entre comillas, y siempre que no salgan de ahí, no haya matrimonios con los cristianos, con protestantes o tal, y no se hagan remarqué. Se fasse pas remarqué.
Yes.
que estén ahí metiditos.
Yes.
Después es una comunidad dominada, controlada por los sefarditas, y a mí esto me parece importante, en la que los askenazi son, están muy mal vistos. Los askenazi son los judíos que proceden de los países del este de Europa, y en la época de Spinoza, me acuerdo, no sé dónde lo he leído, pero que en las sinagogas había como una especie de... ¿Cómo es eso en las iglesias católicas donde se pone el dinero? Eso tiene un nombre...
Cepillo.
Cepillo.
En católico, sí.
Bueno, pues cepillo.
Place you give offerings.
Yes.
Yeah, yes, right.
Yeah,
alms. Yes. Alms, yes, yes.
Eso. Bueno, pues en las sinagogas, en la época de Spinoza, había como cepillos de estos donde los sefarditas entregaban dinero, ponían dinero para que expulsar, realmente, porque esa sería la palabra, expulsar a los askenazi, que eran muy pobres, muy mal visto, llevarlos nuevamente, que se pudieran marchar nuevamente a sus países de origen. Bueno, esto es un poco. Después, es una comunidad, la comunidad judía es una comunidad muy ortodoxa, muy rígida en cuanto a la defensa de los dogmas religiosos, pero también de las costumbres. Entonces, bueno, eso, solamente hay que recordar el caso Uriel da Costa. Hay un libro que no sé si...
La sinagoga vacía.
Claro, la sinagoga vacía.
Yes.
De Gabriel, de Gabriel Albiach, lo conoces, que es Gabriel Albiach,
by
Gabriel
Albiach.
Empty
sinagoga.
Bueno, que explica muy bien todo lo que pasa con el... Spinoza tenía 5 años cuando ocurre el caso Uriel da Costa. Uriel da Costa es un noble portugués que se convierte, entre comillas, al cristianismo, pero que sigue conservando el judaísmo en el interior. Entonces, en un momento determinado está cansado de llevar esta vida de duplicidad y se va con su familia, abandona todo y se va con su familia a Amsterdam, y tiene unas dificultades. Bueno, empieza a hablar libremente porque lo que quiere es se marcha de Portugal, de Lisboa, para poder decir lo que piensa y poder debatir y poder discutir. Y entonces le excomulgan el jerem. El jerem es la excomunión judía, que es una excomunión con un rigor. Bueno, es horrible.
Sí, es la separación, ¿no?
O sea no hay
total scrutia.
Yes.
No hay nadie de la propia colectividad, ni siquiera de tu familia, que te pueda decir la palabra. Y después, bueno, Uriel da Costa le excomulgan y al cabo de 2 meses o 3 meses pide el reingreso, y la segunda vez que vuelve a hablar otra vez libremente. Entonces la segunda excomunión es terrible, porque bueno, la escena que cuenta Gabriel Albiach en la sinagoga con esas... ¿cómo se llama? Lo de cera, las velas rojas de cera.
La religiosa deja mucho que desear, José.
Bueno, pues que la escena es muy bonita, lo que cuenta. Y entonces, desnudo, del torso para arriba, de rodillas, los 12 látigos de la cera. Bueno, Uriel da Costa se suicida cuando Spinoza tiene 5 años. Bueno, yo creo que esto es un aviso para navegantes, para Spinoza. Bueno, Spinoza también va a sufrir un jerem, una excomunión, pero él no asiste y no sufre todo esto. Y además, Spinoza es un... se ha criado, ha nacido en Ámsterdam, y la situación es muy diferente. Pero bueno, un poco la comunidad, la represión que sufre. Spinoza es atacado por un judío, una persona es atacado, le rajan la capa.
I don't understand that.
Túnica.
Yes, the capa. Yes, okay.
They slash him.
Yes. Spinoza.
Y entonces tiene un primer atentado contra su vida dentro de la misma comunidad judía. Bueno, esto es la... Bueno, Spinoza se marcha y tal. Entonces, este es el contexto dentro de la comunidad, esa comunidad muy represiva, muy ortodoxa y tal. Y después, fuera de la comunidad, bueno, Ámsterdam es teóricamente mucho más abierta, porque hay muchas sectas algunas tolerantes, como los cuáqueros, tú citas a los cuáqueros, o los menonitas tolerantes. Entonces, esa necesidad de tolerancia motivada porque las siete provincias del norte de los Países Bajos están o han estado en guerra contra España para conseguir su independencia, y entonces esa necesidad de unir a todo el pueblo independientemente de las creencias. Aunque no hay que olvidar que las siete provincias del norte, y en concreto Holanda, es un estado confesional, sí, que tiene una religión, uh-huh, y que hay unos priestos, bueno, unos curas, unos sacerdotes, unos teólogos, uh-huh, predicadores, teólogos, que son funcionarios estatales que están educados y tal, y pagados por el Estado para defender la ortodoxia religiosa y para denunciar a los disidentes, las reuniones públicas, los libros que se publican, todo esto. O sea que la tolerancia, una tolerancia un poco que fuera de esta comunidad que Espinoza abandona, obligado pero también voluntariamente, porque provoca un poco, se dice que provoca la excomunión, él fuera de esta comunidad, Espinoza, el contexto en el que vive Espinoza, el contexto intelectual y religioso, también es muy represivo. Nunca le dejan publicar, tiene que publicar fuera o bueno. Y después los disidentes son multados o son encarcelados. Kerbach, uh-huh, Kerbach muere en prisión, tú hablas de Kerbach, que era su amigo. Se dice que el Tratado Teológico Político está escrito por Espinoza, entre otras cosas, es un llamamiento a De Witt para que detenga lo que son la represión, las denuncias continuas de esos teólogos protestantes que no permiten la disidencia, no permiten la libertad filosofante, que sería la libertad religiosa, entre otras cosas, ¿no? Entonces, después los intelectuales, el contexto cartesiano también está en contra de Spinoza. Es decir, tanto dentro como fuera de la comunidad, Espinoza se encuentra con un contexto intelectual, religioso, muy, 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 muy represor, ¿no? Una cosa que quería hablar, que no sé, tal vez, no es, bueno, nadie habla de esto, pero a mí me parece que es importante, es el contexto. Bueno, hay mucha gente que se pregunta cuál es el the link entre los la coterie de Spinoza, los seguidores de Spinoza. ¿Qué es lo que une a toda esta gente que está en torno a Spinoza y que nos dice que son libre pensadores? Hay algunos que son libre pensadores y hay otros que son muy, muy, muy religiosos. Entonces, que es muy raro que toda esta gente esté cercana a Spinoza, porque hay como dos corrientes extremadamente contradictorias y divergentes. Entonces, la tesis que yo tengo, y bueno, es que son alquimistas. Bueno, esto no lo puedo explicar.
Nos llevaría largo
claro,
tiempo.
Nos llevaría mucho. Pero he hecho un trabajo, bueno, algunos de los trabajos que yo he hecho, he intentado explicar que no solamente dentro del grupo de Spinoza es un grupo alquimista. Claro, ¿qué entendemos por alquimia? Porque la alquimia en el siglo XVII no es la concepción que nosotros tenemos. Los alquimistas en el siglo XVII son científicos, Newton.
Sí.
Bueno, entonces, yo he intentado reconstruir la red de alquimistas con los que se relacionaba Spinoza. Y entonces es muy, sí, muy importante.
¿Médicos, farmacéuticos?
Farmacéuticos, médicos, químicos, físicos, todos científicos.
Curadores, sí.
Bueno, no solamente. Entonces, el contexto, toda la red, Royal Society of London. Importantísima, con Oldenburg, con sí, Boyle, sí, con Newton fue presidente también. Boyle y Spinoza, que tienen cartas a través de Oldenburg. Boyle es un empírico, o sea que está bastante alejado de Spinoza, que tiene más una, digamos, unos planteamientos más filosóficos, no tan empíricos. Y entonces ahí hay divergencia, pero bueno, toda la Royal Society son alquimistas. Después está Menasseh Ben Israel, tú hablas de Menasseh Ben Israel. Menasseh Ben Israel fue el profesor en la Torah de Spinoza cuando era pequeño. Y después, junto con Serrarius, también hablas, fue, digamos, el mediador entre la Royal Society y Spinoza. Dos, eran alquimistas. Después, Van den Ende. Van den Ende es el ex jesuita, que es profesor de Spinoza. Spinoza vive en su casa, de latín y tal cual. Se cuenta que Van den Ende acudía con Spinoza al laboratorio de Glauber en Ámsterdam. Glauber, no sé cómo se pronuncia, Glauber, G-L-A-U-B-B-I-R.
Glauber,
okay. Very, very, very important.
Yeah.
Bueno, donde se hacían experimentos alquimistas muy importantes. Pues está Huygens, está Meyer. Bueno, hay toda una serie. Yo he reconstruido todo esto. Después, primero, digamos el contexto este, que a mí me parece importante situar con la cuestión alquimista. Bueno, hay unas investigadoras brasileñas que hace un año, año y medio, hicieron un trabajo de investigación en la biblioteca de la Royal Society of London y descubrieron una carta de un farmacéutico del siglo XVII en el que había, junto con la carta, había un pequeño sobre donde había cosa alcaés, que es el elemento alquímico y tal y cual, y bueno. En la correspondencia de Spinoza también hay una carta donde, que pasa es que no me quiero entretener mucho con esto, hay una carta en la que está borrada delayed, la palabra, espérate, ¿qué palabra era? No me acuerdo.
¿Qué importancia tenía la palabra en este contexto?
Pues porque la palabra...
¿Una palabra alquímica o qué?
Sí, claro. Es un componente, es un componente químico.
¿Y por qué estaría borrada? ¿Porque era un secreto o era una herejía?
Bueno, los conocimientos alquímicos solamente se difundían de maestro a discípulo y tenían mucho cuidado, porque una de las cosas era la transformación de los metales.
Claro,
en oro.
Claro, sí.
Había los reyes, desde Cristina de Suecia, bueno, hasta antes Felipe II y Roberto de Praga, bueno, estaban muy interesados en el tema de la transformación del oro. Y
claro,
entonces
claro,
hay,
sí, sí.
Spinoza, hay un hecho en el siglo XVII en Ámsterdam, que hay un alquimista, que hay una transfiguración de oro a la que Spinoza no asiste, pero que está muy interesado, y hay unas cartas en las cuales Spinoza pide información. ¿Me sigues? ¿Can you follow me?
Sí.
Vale, pide información sobre esto y bueno, vale, da igual. Esto quería un poco hacer el contexto, contextualizar un poco lo de Spinoza. El segundo punto que quería mencionar es la relación de Spinoza con el judaísmo y la relación de Spinoza con la religión. Evidentemente, Spinoza está educado en el judaísmo y, bueno, tú lo explicas muy bien. Rompe con el judaísmo,
sí.
pero digamos que los fundamentos están ahí. Tú no puedes, aunque rompas, eliminar todo eso, todos esos pozos que tienes, imposible, ¿no? Entonces el judaísmo siempre está muy presente. Pero lo que sí que hay es una crítica de la Biblia, muy importante, que socava la autoridad de los pastores protestantes. Digamos que la religión en el siglo XVII es un fundamento muy importante para los estados, porque es un fundamento sociopolítico muy importante para el orden social, porque otorga una sanción sobrenatural a las leyes políticas que existen. Luego, en estados confesionales, el poner en cuestión la religión o la base sobre la que se fundamentan las religiones del libro, que es la Biblia, es un auténtico desastre y un auténtico peligro. Si Spinoza tiene la fama de archiateo, de esa fama terrible que tiene en el 17 y en el 18, hasta que lo reivindican los alemanes, los románticos alemanes en el 19, en el siglo 18, los franceses, los ilustrados franceses, todos conocen la obra de Spinoza. Pero nadie se dice discípulo de Spinoza. Y cuando hablan de Spinoza, todos utilizan un adjetivo peyorativo. El ateo, el herético, el no sé qué. Porque no pueden hacer otra cosa, porque Spinoza es el anticristo. Porque está poniendo en cuestión las bases sobre las que se asienta el orden sociopolítico. Por lo tanto, bueno, Spinoza rompe y esa crítica que hace a las Sagradas Escrituras es una crítica feroz, en el sentido, bueno, hay quien dice que está la exégesis bíblica que hace Spinoza está precede o es son los prolegómenos de la exégesis que se hace en el siglo XIX. Está sentando las bases de la exégesis moderna, porque lo que está diciendo de la Biblia es que la Biblia son cuentos, son parábolas para explicar deberes morales a un pueblo inculto, pero todos los dogmas no sirven de nada. Entonces, en ese sentido, la relación que tiene Spinoza con las religiones, tal y como yo lo entiendo, es que cualquier religión es válida para los hombres irracionales, la plebe, el populacho. No para los hombres racionales que se guían por su razón y no necesitan de leyes, ni divinas, ni políticas, porque van a actuar siempre bien, porque se guían por su razón. Pero sí es necesaria cualquier tipo de religión, da igual. Todas las religiones enseñan lo mismo, dejando de lado los aspectos, los dogmas religiosos. Bueno, yo asistí a un congreso que hubo en Chicago que discutía el capítulo 14 del Tratado Teológico Político. El capítulo 14 es el de los dogmas, porque Spinoza en ese es un capítulo del Tratado Teológico Político muy controvertido, porque ahí Spinoza dice que hay una serie de dogmas que los cristianos tienen que aceptar. Entonces, bueno, en este congreso estaba Rosenthal. ¿Conoces a Rosenthal?
No.
Bueno.
De América, americano.
Sí, americano.
Sí. El pasado es un país lejano.
Le Baff, No. Es un especialista en Spinoza. Le Baff, Michael, bueno, otro especialista. Bueno, había una serie. Entonces, cada uno interpreta este capítulo. Dicen, Rosenthal, que es un judío, él pensaba que plantea un nuevo tipo de religión. Bueno, vale. Lo que yo opino es que cualquier tipo de religión, incluso el Islam, tiene alguna, ¿sabes? En el Tratado Teológico Político tiene alguna nota sobre el Islam. Cualquier tipo de religión es válida siempre y cuando enseñen deberes morales, la obediencia a las leyes, el amor al prójimo, la justicia. Vale, esas dos cosas. Bueno, y no me quiero entender una cosa más. Y el tercer punto que quería plantear, poner sobre la mesa, es Spinoza y la democracia. Vale, Spinoza es un seguidor de Van den Enden. Es un discípulo, yo diría más que seguidor, discípulo de Van den Enden. Entonces, yo creo que todas las concepciones políticas de Spinoza, las concepciones democráticas, se encuentran en Van den Enden. Van den Enden. Lo que pasa es que la diferencia entre Spinoza y Van den Enden es también notable. Van den Enden es un ex jesuita radical que se marcha, bueno, no le dejan, vive de dar clases a la burguesía de Ámsterdam, y en un momento le prohíben dar clases y se marcha a París, y en París interviene en una rebelión contra Luis XIV y le cortan el cuello. O sea, Spinoza es mucho más realista y nunca su divisa caute.
Divisa Caute.
No, Divisa Caute.
Oh.
Spinoza.
Yes, okay, yes, Latin. Yes.
Watch and be cautious.
Yes. Sí. Right, yes.
Bueno, pues quiero decir que hay una diferencia entre Van den Enden, que se mete en una revuelta y que le llevan a tal, y Spinoza, cuya divisa es cuidado, caute, sé cuidadoso y tal. Entonces es mucho más realista. Entonces, la posición de Spinoza, ¿hasta dónde llega sus planteamientos democráticos? Bueno, pues eso está en discusión, hay mucha discusión en torno a los planteamientos democráticos por su realismo, porque en el tratado teológico político, lo que dice es que el mejor régimen y el más acorde con la naturaleza es el régimen democrático. Pero en el tratado político habla de los tres regímenes, y entonces lo que hace es aportar. Él sabe que en el siglo XVII, el XVII es el siglo de las monarquías absolutas, la democracia no es posible. Entonces lo que hace es dar hints, o no sé cómo se diría, una serie de ¿cómo se dice esto? Sí, de remedios, de puntos, de para que en el caso tanto de la monarquía como de la aristocracia, esos dos regímenes se pueda conservar la libertad, los individuos puedan conservar la libertad. Y después el tratado político queda inconcluso. Y dice un poco sobre la democracia, pero bueno, entonces hay muchos debates sobre por qué Spinoza lo deja, porque coincide. Una de las tesis es que muere, y lo deja inconcluso porque muere, y otra tesis es porque el contexto en esos momentos es de una bueno, el príncipe de Orange y los orangistas, la revuelta contra los hermanos Brothers, David Brothers y todo esto, que son acuchillados y tal por la plebe, y que entonces no veía solución el panfleto ese que dice que tal, bueno, todas estas historias que cuentan. Entonces, la democracia, Spinoza y la democracia, ¿hasta dónde llega? O hasta, si no es más bien un pensador, no es nada utópico, está claro, un pensador realista que lo que hace es una defensa de la libertad, pero que piensa que en los otros regímenes también, si se cumplen determinadas formas. Si, por ejemplo, en el régimen monárquico, el rey, el sucesor del rey, no es elegido por el rey, sino por el consejo, por la población. Si, por ejemplo, el ejército queda fuera del control del rey, hay toda una serie de medidas para que la libertad se pueda conservar. Bueno, eran los tres puntos que quería un poco añadir como...
Okay. Thank you very much, María Luisa. There's a lot there. Very, very interesting. I don't think you said anything I disagreed with. You said some things that I wasn't familiar with, but I'm very interested in, like your research on alchemy and the importance of alchemy in his scientific networks. And I absolutely think that all the three areas you raised, his circle and the social framework in which you move, is very important and complex. His relationship to Judaism and to religion more generally is very important and complex. And also his political thought, his relationship to democracy, differences between what's suggested in the TTP, the Tractatus Theologicus Politicus, and then the more, I think you were saying, in the Tractatus Politicus, which is incomplete, he seems to be more open to different forms of government. All of this... my starting point with Spinoza is a little bit different in that I'm interested in why there is so much why there is today, why there has been over the last 300 years, and why there was in the late 17th century already a very special fascination with Spinoza, and I think quite often. A desire to believe that he is at the center of the various forms of change in European intellectual history that you were discussing. And he's somehow the node, the linchpin of new forms of thought emerging in the late 17th century. And I think a lot of this has to do with the special associations that people in his circle had with Judaism in the late 17th century, and which, although they've changed over time in their basic underlay, in their essential features, they remain with us today. So, to start with some of the points we were raising at the beginning about the Jewish community and his place within the Jewish community. Certainly, there were elements of repression and, you know, policing of the boundaries of the acceptable in the Sephardic community of Amsterdam. But the extent to which this was the case it's quite hard to say. It's very complicated, and there were quite a lot of people who were Portuguese-speaking, Iberian, ethnic Jews who had come to Amsterdam and who hadn't converted formally to Judaism. So they were culturally part of the Sephardic community in some sense, but were nominally Christian, indeed Catholic, and who were in a sort of a grey area in terms of where they sat socially. Josef Kaplan, a scholar in Jerusalem, has written about them. There's a fascinating writer called Miguel de Barrios, who sort of commuted between Brussels and Amsterdam, and had two personae, and wrote Spanish poetry as a new Christian in the Spanish Netherlands, and yet was clearly seen as a Jew in the Jewish world in Amsterdam. So one can see a certain kind of fluidity in the Sephardic world in the Low Countries in the late 17th century as well. Oriol de Costa, it's been a while since I looked at the case of Oriol de Costa, so I'm not confident in what I say, but it's the source. The main source of his life is his autobiography, the account of him being whipped as a punishment for his heresies and then committing suicide. It has been suggested, certainly by some scholars, that this might not be an authentic autobiography, that his fate might not have been as described. Certainly, he was expelled. He went to Hamburg, I think. He pleaded to rejoin the Jewish community, and Spinoza would have known about this. I think you said Spinoza was five years old. Yes, when this happened, and it would have made an impression on him. But we have this vivid account of the suffering and the vicious punishment of Oriol de Costa that could have been written retrospectively. Later in the 17th century or the 18th century even, by those who believed that this Sephardic community was deeply repressive and dark, and Spinoza was rebelling from it, taking the step that Oriol de Costa had tried but been unable ultimately to make. And that view of Spinoza's background, it maps onto classic Christian views of Jesus and the Pharisees and the sectarian repressiveness of Jerusalem during Jesus' life, and Jesus as the rebel from that blinkered, repressive world. So I think we just have to be a bit sort of skeptical about some of these accounts.
Pero puedo,
yeah, sí.
¿Puedo decir una cosa?
Yes.
Es normal que la comunidad judía fuera represiva y tuviera ese control sobre sus miembros, porque era tolerada. Sí. Y entonces dependía de que las autoridades le siguieran permitiendo. Entonces,
sí.
es, es, es normal que hubiera un control muy fuerte por parte de sus miembros.
And the same applied to Catholics in Amsterdam. It was all non-Protestants, everyone not in the Dutch Reformed Church who needed to be careful to
sí, lo que pasa es que pero los católicos no constituían esa especie de gueto, estaban mucho más dispersos.
Yes, yes.
La comunidad judía era una comunidad con dirigentes políticos, religiosos y con ritos muy muy básicos, la comida.
Yes. But it was blurred around the edges. There was a lot. There were certainly members of the community who affluent Sephardic figures who were major investors in trade and who hosted rich Dutch people at their homes and probably didn't observe the laws of Kashrut strictly. There was a complicated overlap with the Ashkenazic community. Yes, there was hostility to some extent, but I mean, one interesting source for this is the regulations of the Sephardic community, which have lots and lots of edicts forbidding the Sephardim to do X, Y, Z, like don't buy your meat from the Ashkenazic butcher. So you can read that as saying, well, this is very repressive, they're trying to police where the Jews buy their meat, the Sephardic Jews buy their meat. You could also argue, well, they wouldn't have repeatedly issued those rules were it not the case that lots of the Sephardic Jews were buying their meat from Ashkenazic butchers that might have been cheaper and would have been seen as not properly kosher by the Sephardim. There are also rules repeatedly about young Jews mustn't sort of, young Jewish men shouldn't mingle with Christian women at this bridge or that bridge. Mm-hmm. Presumably because they did.
Exactly. To some extent. This is actually something that extends still practically the 20th century. I'm thinking right now of the trilogy by Elias Canetti.
Yes.
And he is Sephardic. Mm-hmm. And he explains that his family considered themselves the aristocrats of Judaism.
Yes.
And he's told repeatedly by his mother and by his uncle, don't you dare marry an Ashkenazi girl.
Yes.
Remember who you are. You're a Sephardic Jew.
Yes.
And that's amazing. I mean, we're talking about Vienna in the 20th century.
Yes, yes, yes. And I wrote an article about a figure in the 18th century called Isaac de Pinto, who was a Sephardic Jew in Amsterdam. And he writes to Voltaire, who's infamously anti-Jewish in a number of his pronouncements. Pinto wanted to be a figure of the Enlightenment. He loved Voltaire. And he wrote to Voltaire essentially saying, Mr. Voltaire, you're so wonderful, but all these things you say about Jews, they're true, but not about us Sephardim. They're only true about the Ashkenazim. Yes, they're true. Lots of Jews, they are dirty and primitive and barbaric and smelly, but not us. You know, we're Sephardic. We're classy. We're like you. We wear nice powdered wigs. It has been described by one historian as essentially Sephardic anti-Ashkenazic anti-Semitism.
Yes, there was that kind of a divide. It's amazing.
Yes.
Can I ask a question? I found it a wonderful paper. I loved it. I'm interested, and I thought like the things you've said now about Spinoza made me just, my head just exploded. I want to now go into all this alchemist stuff. I think it could be combined very nicely with all the stuff you say about the Kabbalah. All of that could, it opens tremendous doors. But what I thought was really interesting is this attempt to overcome the divide, the anti-Semitism versus philo-Semitism, the two sides of the spectrum, let's say, which indeed is, I think, has been a common theme throughout the history of at least modern Judaism. It's not just a modern thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking right now of several important moments. I'm thinking, for example, of the discussions in the United States among the Jewish community that writes books. One side saying, we've made it, we are now just like the Anglo-whites,
mm-hmm.
and very happy for it. And the others that say, if we continue that way, we'll cease to be Jews. We better go back to limiting ourselves, or with this story now of globalization versus nationalisms, you have, for example, accusations that globalization equals Judaism, for mm-hmm. example, and somebody as important as Jacques Attali in France recently came out and said, literally, those who are anti-globalists are basically anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. So, again, I think we're finding it's very hard to somehow synthesize both the obvious desire for universality with the equally obvious need to defend the particularism. And somehow in that always imperfect thesis, there will always be a conflict somehow, it seems to me.
Yes, I think what you've said really strikes, goes to the heart of what my wider project is about. One word I do avoid in the book is ambivalence, which was a word that easily leaps to mind when thinking about this tension between, on the one hand, wanting to look forward to a universalism in which divisions between us are overcome. Who wouldn't want that? While at the same time, if you're part of a community and people, that's your sense of who you are, your sense of where you belong, and that's a hard thing to wish to let go of. And there is a tussle between those forces. To call it ambivalent, I think, stops the exploration precisely where it needs to begin, which has to be an excavation of quite how these two impetuses function together. And I think there's a huge amount of confusion about this, I think, in related to Jews in particular, which emerge in these sorts of pronouncements by Jacques Attali and a number of other people have said.
I want
this,
to add
this
one,
sort of thing.
One last
yes.
thing.
Yes.
Which I found fascinating. I did a review of a book, which I don't know if you are acquainted with. It's called "The Sephardism and the Literary Imaginary, the Literary Imagination" by Yael Halevi Wise, I think is her name. Sephardism and
In English,
Sephardism, Spanish Jewish History, and the Modern Literary Imagination. And in it, she closes with an anecdote about a philosopher, a female Jewish philosopher called let me tell you, her name is Rebecca Goldstein.
Oh, yes.
And Rebecca Goldstein has a book called Betraying Spinoza.
Yes, yes. I've written about that book, yes.
In which she basically says, I don't care. I make him mine because I make him Jewish. I reclaim him.
Yes. And it's betraying Spinoza because she understands that Spinoza, on her account of Spinoza, Spinoza wants to overcome his Jewishness.
Yes.
And to.
But she's determined to bring him back into the fold.
Yes. Yes.
And I think this shows best that ambivalence that you're talking about.
Yes.
You know.
And it becomes extremely charged in contemporary debate when, on the one hand, sometimes people say, well, if you're against globalization, you're anti-Semitic. If you're hostile to America and, you know, the American power, you're anti-Semitic. On the other hand, if you don't accept Jewish self-determination as the basis for, you know, the state of Israel, then you're anti-Semitic.
Yes,
so to reject the universal or to reject the particular can be deemed to be anti-Semitic, and that's a very it's a sort of trump card to play in any
but
argument
I think
today.
It's because,
I think it's very problematic.
The Jews are
yes.
between a rock and a hard place because it is a stance that is basically trying to square the circle to keep both together, universality and uniqueness in one single.
The way I want to put it is, it isn't that the Jews are between a rock and a hard place. We're all in that place. You know, we all have hopes for a better future in which our divisions are overcome. But we all have our particularities and these have been, this idea has been tightly bound up with understandings of the Jews and their world historical purpose through history. And, you know, from a Jew, and in the project, I look at Jews and non-Jews together in their discussion of this. And I refuse to say, well, there's a Christian discourse and a Jewish response somehow to it. Even if one looks at Zionism, both Christians and Jews have invoked Zionism as this great contribution to the world, and there wouldn't have been a Balfour Declaration, there wouldn't have been a State of Israel if it hadn't been promoted in that way. But it has also been defended as a bastion of particularism. I think that's the case today. You know, why are so many nationalist states so admiring of Israel? Because they see Israel as the ultimate ethno-nationalist state, which Donald Trump, Viktor Orban, you know, many other leaders in the world today want to emulate, and the resonance of a Jewish particularist model is very, very potent. So yes, that's the sort of deeper politics of the project. I want to sort of bring that. I could say more and more and more, but anybody else who wants to throw another?
Uno, dos. Yo quería también hablar.
May I ask him a question in Spanish?
Absolutely,
okay.
I will interrupt you as soon as I don't understand.
Word.
Yes,
no.
If I understand.
Okay.
Listen, if
you
single
no,
word,
you told me, and
even
yeah.
just one
okay.
word, I don't understand also.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, la primera cuestión es para continuar esta discusión, uh-huh. es que precisamente la discusión entre universalismo e identidad uh-huh. no es judía, es propia uh-huh. de es un debate sí. contemporáneo que atañe a todo el mundo, ¿vale?
Sí.
Eso es cierto, pero hay una cuestión en el judaísmo que, aunque está en las otras religiones, este debate, uh-huh. hay una cuestión en el judaísmo que es particularmente importante, y es que es el único que se llama a sí mismo pueblo elegido. Pueblo elegido. Es realmente el problema de la normalización del judaísmo, no solo desde Spinoza, siempre. Y es el problema precisamente que intenta sobrepasar y discutir el mesianismo, que es el pueblo elegido es la clave fundamental, que recupera, por cierto, el protestantismo, que también se crea a sí mismo pueblo elegido, recupera precisamente la tradición judía a partir de ahí. Entonces, creo que el debate sobre el concepto de pueblo elegido, que lo tratas en la cuestión de Spinoza, pero me gustaría saber cómo se ha tratado en general en el libro, porque creo que esa es la parte fundamental de la identidad de los judíos. Y la segunda parte es una cuestión más particular, que tiene que ver con tu investigación sobre Mendelssohn.
Uh-huh.
Y es sobre el contexto en Alemania, y de qué forma la tradición protestante, de nuevo alemana, en ese momento, es quien apoya realmente el proyecto de Mendelssohn.
Apoya.
¿Tradición o tradición?
No, tradición. Uh-huh. No, tradición. Uh-huh. Tradition. Uh-huh. La tradición protestante alemana en ese momento.
Uh-huh.
Es quien recupera realmente el interés de Mendelssohn. O sea, si fuera solamente el apoyo de los judíos, Mendelssohn no hubiera llegado tan lejos uh-huh. como llegó, y menos uh-huh. en el debate. El debate sobre Legatier es interesante.
Uh-huh.
Entonces, estas dos cuestiones, el francés, la discusión sobre la cuestión francesa, sobre los textos de, ¿cómo se llama este hombre? Lava.
Escríbelo.
No, es que tengo que mirarlo. Eso no es el nombre del señor.
Lavatier. Sí. Es Suizo.
Sí.
Yes. Yes.
Dos cosas.
Okay, yes. And the chosen people point connects to some of the things
yes.
you were saying, María Luisa, as well.
María José, sorry.
Absolutely, it's fundamentally important, the question of, you know, what does it mean to be a chosen people, and that's where I start the book, in a sense, within the Jewish tradition. You know, what rabbinical interpretations of these phrases in Isaiah and elsewhere, the Jews are a chosen people, for what?
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be for the world, not just for Jews themselves. Spinoza addresses this directly, and I think I discussed it in my text, that he says, well, because God is universal, God is nature, clearly the Jews can't be the chosen people in the sense that they are singled out above all. They're just an example of a people and their history. And he says that when he comes to Moses, this connects with your points, about democracy and politics. It says that Moses has this revealed law and political system from God that are social arrangements that Moses is in some way illuminated, enlightened by the divine to give the Jews a political system that is perfectly adapted for them. And he says that in this domain it is meaningful for different laws to be created for different people. It's where ethics, for example, are universal, have to be the same for everybody. When it comes to political arrangements, they can be different for particular people according to their natures. And he says, what he effectively says is, presumably God provided similar guidance to other people, but we don't have records of them, at least not in the Jewish Bible. Possibly elsewhere.
Describe.
Sorry?
Minutely describe.
Yes, we don't have the same detail. So how might one interpret this? Now, I suspect some people at your conference in Chicago, certainly my supervisor, Jonathan Israel, he was my PhD supervisor, he would say, I think, well, obviously Spinoza doesn't believe in God at all. He just pretends to believe in God, because of the repressiveness of the Dutch confessional state. As you were saying, he got into enough hot water, enough trouble writing what he wrote with this fig leaf of religious language. If he'd been overtly atheist, it would have been far too dangerous. So that's one interpretation of Spinoza. And I don't accept that interpretation. I think quite a lot of people do. It's quite commonly held. I don't accept it, and in some ways this connects to what you were talking about, Maria Jose, about alchemy and about the various ways in which forms of thought that we think of as superstitious, mystical, irrational were very important in Cartesian, experimental, radical thought in the late 17th century. I don't think there's evidence not to take Spinoza at his word. What he means exactly by God, one could endlessly probe and discuss. But I think he does think that the Mosaic law is inspired, and inspired in some sort of special way. So other people may have been inspired similarly, he says. And based on that statement alone, he is rejecting the idea of Jews as a chosen people. But and this is easier for him to do than others in his circle, because for Spinoza, he can see the Jewish Bible as the story of his people, as like an ethnic document of one particular group. But he's got a reason to be interested in it, because it's his ethnic group. For those in his circle who are Protestants or post-Protestants, and you, Maria Jose, you talked about his circle, including some people who were thought of as free thinkers, as atheists perhaps, others who were clearly passionately Christian. And so I don't think the separation can be made at all starkly in that way. But for all of those people of a Christian background, the special status of the Jewish Bible or the Old Testament needs some sort of explanation. And it can't be just simply, oh, this is one example that for Jews could be seen as just interesting to us because it's our example. So this leads to lots of people in Spinoza's circle, like Korbach, who I think you mentioned, who was died in police custody, a radical who was close to Spinoza. And his approach to the Old Testament is to denigrate it, to say this is ridiculous, it's full of crazy superstition and a literalist idea of God writing with his fingers on the tablets of the commandments, appearing on a cloud, and what a ridiculous, stupid way of conceiving of the divine. So he attacks the Old Testament. Spinoza, he talks of the Jews as being like children.
Naive
as a primitive text, but he also, I'm looking for the quote in my paper if I can find it. When he writes about circumcision, and he's reflecting on the survival of the Jewish people as a minority, despite sort of persecution by Christians over a millennium and a half and he does seem to think of this as rather extraordinary, and then says that the Jews, they've been preserved by hatred. This hatred from others has actually bound them more closely together. So has circumcision. And then he writes, I will not hesitate to believe that they will one day, given the opportunity, establish once more their independent state, and that God will again choose them. So, why does he say that? He could have said it because so many of the non-Jews in his circle, and he was the only Jew in his, well, actually that's not quite true, he did also have some in his, well, as a young, in his 20s, he was in contact with some other free-thinking people in the Sephardic world, Rambam, Chabad, and others, but by the 1660s and 70s, the radicals he mixes with are all from a Protestant background, or from an end, and from a Catholic background. They're fascinated with the idea of the Jews, once chosen, now no longer loved by God, but again being chosen at the end of days. So this is resonant for the people who are surrounding him. But he says it, so maybe he just simply felt that in some way. I think one has to, unless there's a good reason the contrary, you have to approach these texts as meaning what they say. So I think he did feel that there was something mysterious and wondrous about Jewish survival as a people, and this idea that in the future the Jews would play some important role in bringing about a better world for everybody. I think that's what he means by God will again choose them. He can't quite let go of that. So he does maintain some idea of a chosen people. You want to have a question as well on this? And then, yeah, no, yes.
I was going to say, do you think it might be ironic what he's saying? But that was just I just throw that in. Go ahead.
It could be,
and it's very hard.
The way he's spoken about Judaism the whole time, and the way he's separated himself.
He says they're children. Yes.
A child is expected to grow up.
Yes, a child is expected to grow up. Lessing, by the way, uses the same language. And then very briefly, I can say something about your second point about Protestant support for Mendelssohn's project. Well, it depends what we think Mendelssohn's project was. I think Mendelssohn's project as a leader in the Haskalah, Jewish Enlightenment, was to modernize Jewish culture, to try to bring the Jews of Central and Eastern Europe more into contact with the world of letters and knowledge, and science and mathematics, to encourage Yiddish-speaking Jews to understand German, to promote the study of the Bible itself, not simply the rabbinic commentary on the Bible, the Talmud. That's his central project. And I don't think many, or any Christians, were very interested in that. His defense of Judaism in Jerusalem, his book Jerusalem, he didn't want to write it. So I think he preferred having like two parts of his mind, his Enlightenment German part as a friend of Lessing, and then his role within the Jewish community. And he was uncomfortable about having to bring them together. And he did so because he was repeatedly by Lavater and then by Krantz and others pressured to do so. But I think those people, those Christians, Protestants, many of them, Lavater was a sort of Calvinist pastor from Switzerland. Krantz, a bit later in the 1680s, was a free thinker, was a radical. Both in different ways, they sincerely were very sincerely excited by Mendelssohn and thought that he was bringing about transformations in the Jewish world that would be of great importance in the overcoming divisions between Jews and Christians, and thus divisions in the world in general. And they were very well-meaning in their pressuring Mendelssohn to clarify his view on certain points and to go further, to be more radical. It says, if you're going to adapt certain rules in the Jewish tradition, why not adapt more? I mean, Mendelssohn came out rejected the idea that rabbis could expel from the community those that they disagreed with, as Spinoza had been expelled from the Jewish community in the previous century. And then Kant writes, well, if you're going to change that, and that's been part of Judaism since the beginning, as far as one knows, why not go further? Why not move the Jewish Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday? Why not move the rules that, you know, Jews can't eat pork, then they could eat with everybody else? You know? And not going quite so far, but some of those rules were adapted by reformed Jews not so much later. So I'm not sure if that's precisely what you mean, but in that sense, I think these Protestants who were trying to engage Mendelssohn in discussion, they were supportive of a kind of reform of Judaism, mm-hmm. which something quite similar to that did emerge in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And many of Mendelssohn's descendants were, you know, some of them were involved in that. But Mendelssohn himself, Moses Mendelssohn, that he didn't.
Okay.
He didn't go so want far. That. He didn't go so far. He wanted okay, to go a tiny bit. Some other people.
Sí, quizá propondría una ronda de preguntas. Y luego quizá una respuesta porque la hora un poco se va a
No,
I mean that we all have the question and then you finish. Sí, pues si quieres hablar, Esther, luego
vale,
iba a hablar, tú querías también comentar algo.
Sí, yo solo voy a preguntar dos cosas porque si no, no... La cuestión del pueblo elegido, como nosotros hemos más o menos conocido la transmisión al puritanismo, sobre todo en Estados Unidos, con las colonias, y como la tradición puritana hereda mucho más el judaísmo que otro tipo de reforma o el catolicismo en ese momento. Uh-huh. Y para los puritanos en Norteamérica es una especie de transmisión del legado judío.
O sea, mm-hmm. que el Chosen People...
La transición de la...
Legacy. O sea, lo que una vez fue el pueblo judío elegido por Dios para el covenant, para el pacto,
sí.
es ahora con nosotros cuando llega a su verdadera uh-huh. expresión, ¿no?
Uh-huh.
Por tanto, el mesianismo es nuestro ahora.
Uh-huh.
Eso es una cosa. Solo si quieres decir algo y tal, o si tienes alguna opinión sobre uh-huh. esta tesis. Y luego, la cuestión de que el catolicismo actual, por lo menos su escatología, acepta la idea de que los hermanos separados, los judíos, uh-huh. también hermanos mayores,
uh-huh.
serán en su reingreso a una comunidad unificada, uno de los símbolos de la segunda venida de Cristo, o sea que, digamos, el catolicismo, este es isocial, o sea que ha asumido que el legado judío, o sea, que el cristianismo es una especie de digresión de la historia judía, de la elección, y que finalmente convergerá. Y luego, solo una pequeña cosa sobre la falta de virilidad de la que se acusa siempre a los judíos. The fundamental principles of the religion discourage manliness.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Entonces es algo que yo siempre estudiando a Mandeville, que es uh-huh. lo que más o menos tengo algo de idea. Siempre la cuestión de efemenesis, o sea, con judíos y tal, o sea, y también una cuestión propia de los judíos respecto a sí mismos, o sea, que llega hasta los irlandeses, hasta Joyce, en su obra moderna y tal, la cuestión de la falta de virilidad de los judíos, su carácter femenino, su carácter llorón, su carácter maternal, etcétera, inutilidad para la guerra, por tanto, de los judíos. Nada más.
Should I respond to that now, or do you other people want to say something?
Later. Later. No.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes.
Pues muy telegráfico, muy de forma muy telegráfica. Me ha servido mucho la presentación del libro para contextualizar el texto. De hecho, en 6 meses lo leeré encantado y me iba preguntando muchas dudas sobre, ¿hablará de Levinas? ¿Hablará de Sartre y la cuestión judía? ¿Hablará de Heidegger? El problema de los judíos para Heidegger es que son cosmopolitas, no tienen roots, raíces, no están apegados a la tierra. Pero bueno, por centrarnos un poco en el texto, en el paper, yo lo que quería preguntar tiene que ver con la tesis de Jacobi. Jacobi hace una línea que sería judaísmo, Spinoza, ilustración. El judaísmo lleva Spinoza, sobre todo la cábala, la idea de esa divinidad, endless one, eso lleva Spinoza, y Spinoza lleva al ateísmo y al determinismo de la ilustración. Eso para Jacobi es terrible, por eso él recurre a la fe, pero a mí me parecía que esto era un poco como en el mundo moderno la tesis de Jonathan Israel. Lo único que Jonathan Israel la prueba, Spinoza es el padre de la ilustración y la ilustración es el origen del mundo moderno. Y creo que es un poco también la tesis de este estudioso de Spinoza, Steven Adler, que tiene un libro sobre el judío renegado que nos dio el mundo moderno, The Renegade Jew That Gave Us the Modern World. Claro, el problema de esa tesis, yo diría, es que creo que olvida que en el siglo XVII, the 17th century, la Biblia es muy importante. The Bible is very important. Tiene un significado, has a meaning that we have to discover, whatever it is. En el siglo XVIII, ya la Biblia no le importa a nadie. O sea, lo que escribe Hobbes, Spinoza sobre la Biblia, no lo encontramos, por ejemplo, en Hume, no lo encontramos en Adam Smith, no hay nada de la Biblia en la teoría de los sentimientos morales o en la riqueza de las naciones. Y la Biblia vuelve a ser importante en el mundo alemán, que es un mundo romántico idealista, llega hasta Hegel con la vida de Jesús, pero en ese proceso se ha olvidado elementos de la Ilustración como el empirismo. El utilitarismo, la importancia de la economía política, el individualismo, el sentimentalismo moral. O sea, como que si tenemos una visión más amplia de lo que es la Ilustración, de pronto yo creo que la tradición judía queda como un poco esquinada, queda en el in one corner of the 18th century, and it becomes very important in the 19th century in the German war, and because of that it becomes very important in all the world. Pero no un poco en todo lo que sería la tradición, para mí un poco como más moderna, que sería la Ilustración inglesa, americana, seguramente parte de la Ilustración francesa, donde el judaísmo no es un problema, aunque el judaísmo vaya siendo un problema porque hay mucho antisemitismo en el siglo XIX francés, pero no en las teorías políticas del siglo XVIII, que son como claramente cosmopolitas. Entonces mi pregunta sería ¿cómo ves esto? Porque al final lo que estamos discutiendo es si el judaísmo es el origen de la modernidad, o si eso pues es una tesis un poco como un poco exagerada.
Exaggerated. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Había
yo creo que
nos continuamos en el
yo quería insistir en la ligazón de modernidad judaica y protestantismo, y creo que es lo que mueve a Weber a probar que no es el judaísmo sino el protestantismo el que revela el espíritu moderno, la economía, la producción. Pero ahí yo estuve en un ciclo reciente sobre Weber y vi que hay un vacío en el tema judaico en Weber. Lo trata, dice que no, o sea, lo elude, pero creo que el origen de la modernidad judaica contesta la tesis de Weber.
Ok, yes.
¿Puedo decir que no? Bueno, pues así muy rápido. Es que te has referido a que en Spinoza no hay como ningún intento de engañar, que tú piensas que no hay ningún intento de engañar. He doesn't pretend. Bueno, entonces, que una de las de esto, Congreso de Chicago, decía eso, lo contrario que tú estás diciendo. Yo creo que en este hay dos problemas. Por una parte, en el capítulo 14, cuando Spinoza se está refiriendo a los no racionales, que sí que tienen que creer en una serie de cosas, y otra cosa es el lenguaje que él utiliza. Todos pensamos en una caja teórica, en una especie como de
una caja, una box, a box, yes, of course, caja.
Entonces Spinoza tiene el lenguaje del que dispone, que es un lenguaje beatitud, unión con Dios, todas esas cosas. Entonces el problema es el significado de ese lenguaje. Él no le da el significado usual, el significado judeocristiano. Porque en ese capítulo 14, después de hablar de los dogmas, él dice, ¿y qué es Dios? Bueno, cada uno puede pensar lo que quiera, que es fuego, que es, yo qué sé, no sé, da igual. Es que eso no importa. Lo único que importa son las cuestiones morales, lo que enseñan las religiones. Lo demás, la cuestión teológica de qué sea Dios, da igual. Eso por una parte. Después, sobre el tema de la identidad, sería interesante tal vez para ti que vieras lo que dice Rousseau. En el proyecto de constitución para Córcega, sus dos últimas obras políticas, que son obras en las que reivindica la identidad nacional, sobre todo en las consideraciones para el gobierno de Polonia. Uno de los ejemplos que pone es el pueblo judío. Moisés le otorgó al pueblo judío con toda una serie de ritos que le impedían mezclarse con otros pueblos, y eso ha permitido que conservase su identidad nacional. Es el modelo por excelencia de la identidad nacional. Después, la importancia de la Biblia. Bueno, en el 18 hay muchos autores que no, pero por ejemplo sí. Y lo que me parece muy interesante, y que sí que habría que tal vez discutir más, es lo que tú has planteado, la relación entre judaísmo y modernidad. Porque en el siglo XIX y comienzos del XX, la Viena de comienzos del XX, digamos que el impulso modernizador, por ejemplo, Viena, que es uno de los centros, son todos judíos, en música, en literatura, en filosofía, en todo, es todo judío. Entonces, sí que sería muy interesante ver esa relación, por lo menos en determinadas épocas y en determinados momentos. Viena, fin de siglo.
Okay, so I try to be very brief. How long do we have to be out of here?
Seven minutes.
I'll try in 5 minutes.
Okay.
We'll
continue later.
We drink. I ask you a couple of questions.
Great. The more questions, the better. Starting with Gerardo's question about I think you're absolutely right that Jacobi and Jonathan Israel argue the same thing, but with a different valorization. And there have been many forms of the argument that, you know, Jews are the creators of modernity. And I think often these are quite problematic arguments. They're triumphalist arguments that then, to be very, very blunt, those same arguments, if they come from in a slightly different form, can then be deemed as anti-Semitic because they're seeing Jews as exceptional, and, you know, how dare a non-Jew see a Jew as exceptional. But there's a strong tradition within the Jewish tradition, as well as in Christianity and in the wider Western tradition, of seeing the Jews as special, as the chosen people. Certainly it's exaggerated, and there are some thinkers such as Hume for whom it's not really a topic of focus. It's not that everyone is obsessed with Jews all the time, but they do crop up a lot, and there are sociological arguments that could apply for Vienna around 1900 and for Spinoza in the late 17th century. The idea that being an outsider from the dominant culture and having sort of cross-fertilization of different perspectives creates more innovation and novelty in thinking. So that many German Jews in Vienna in the fin de siècle were inside and outside the dominant culture, and therefore more, you know, the only modernists by any mean, but they were disproportionately involved in those modernist ideas. And I think another thinker who could be added to your list, to Jonathan Israel, Stephen Nadler, is Yirmiyahu Yovel, Israeli, who's written a number of books about the Maranos the origins of modernity. Yes, but this is just one example.
Yes, but the idea there is different. That I could agree with Yovel that there is a sense of not belonging to one community, being from another, two different perspectives, this kind of split of your identity.
Yes.
And this subjectivist idea, this is really important in the modern world.
Yes.
So perhaps I would say that this thesis is more convincing, perhaps.
Yes, but, and I think...
The literary war, for example.
I'd rather put it this way, it's much more interesting to think about, rather than who's more modern than...
I mean, to be an outsider is very important to create modernity.
Yes. No, I think that's true, and it's not uninteresting. And I think I say something along those lines. But I think it's more interesting to think about this in a philosophical way, and about how the idea of having a sense of one's own identity one that is destined to be for the good of all humanity, ultimately. I think that idea is a very, very rich one, a very a difficult one to escape from, and it's been linked to the Jews again and again and again. So, so the Weber thesis that you were inventing, and this also connects to your point as well. I think it is the case that both in terms of the sense of covenant in North America and Protestant chosenness, and in the economic domain of Protestants and Jews being candidates for being at the fore of the development of capitalism. Both of these are ways in which, in the Protestant case, there's a clear understanding of how this idea of being separate but then destined to transform the universal applies. And so that's why, coming back to one of the things I said at the beginning, incorporating especially southern Europe, Spain, Italy, into the story is less it's less obvious. But I think that Spanishness also is an identity that finds its meaning through its sense of purpose.
Wow.
Surely, there's been some interesting scholarship that I know of Philo Sephardista, the Second Republic, and of a sense that this is an affinity between Sephardic culture and a certain understanding, I think, of Hispanic-ness and its purpose in the world.
I find that book, Sephardism, fascinating in that sense.
The book that you wrote about, yes.
It deals with Sephardism all the way as far as New Mexico, Guatemala.
Yes. Is it a recent book? I think I might not know the book, but I might know the author.
2 years ago, yeah.
A young American...
I think she's Canadian.
Canadian.
I'm not sure.
Yes.
Halaby Weiss is her name. Yael. Yes. Halaby.
Right. I'll write that down. Yes, so there are other aspects to the project that I should have covered. I do have Sartre and Levinas in the book. Heidegger barely at all, but he could have been there. There's so much that could have been there.
Okay.
Just exactly.
Thank you for all that.